Good evening and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Clubs in Forum, Connect Your Intellect. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org and on Twitter at InforumSF. I'm Caroline Moriarty-Sachs. I'm the director of InForum and welcome you to tonight's program. Marketing these days is strategic and holistic and involves a whole lot of genuine social media management. Renowned marketing guru Guy Kawasaki is famous for creating strong product evangelism and for his legendary marketing methods. Tonight, he's going to show us how to take relationships with customers, employees, and our colleagues to the next level by affecting their hearts and minds. Now is your chance to meet him, so let's get started. Please help join me in welcoming Guy Kawasaki.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I have to tell you, the first thing I'm going to do is I'm going to take a picture of you because this is like a big deal to speak at the Commonwealth Club, really. So I'm going to post this to my Facebook page that, you know, this is what it's like to be Hillary Clinton or a big political leader to speak on this stage. I'm very honored to be here. I'm going to talk to you today about enchantment. A quick background of myself. I worked for Apple from 1983 to 1987. I was Apple's software evangelist. And after that, I started some software companies. I became a writer and speaker. I returned to Apple, second tour of duty, as a chief evangelist. And then I left to start what became a venture capital firm called Garage Technology Ventures. But I'm not here as a venture capitalist tonight. I'm here as an author. I'm the author of a book called Enchantment, and I'd like to explain the process of enchanting people. Arguably, it's something that I've been doing since 1979 or so. I started in the jewelry business, believe it or not, and the jewelry business is a business of enchantment because you are essentially taking commodities, albeit expensive commodities, and trying to convince people that there's, you know, romance and value and all the beauty in jewelry. From then, it was the Apple evangelism shtick that I did. So I use a top 10 format for my presentations because I've seen many high-tech CEOs, CMOs, CIOs, CTOs, basically CXOs speak. And the two things I learned about the high-tech speakers is first that they pretty much all suck as speakers. And the second thing I learned is that they not only suck, they also go long. And that is a deadly combination. If you are lousy and you go short, it's okay. And if you're good and you go long, it's okay. But if you suck and you go long, it's like being stupid and arrogant. That's not a good combination. So I use a top 10 format so that in case you think I suck, you know approximately how much longer I'll suck. At least you can track progress through my presentation. Of course, I forgot to put my little remote here, so I'm going to have to press the space bar here. The starting point of enchantment is to achieve likability. If you just ask yourself, have you ever been enchanted by someone you didn't like? It's highly unlikely that that is true. And so what I figured out is the starting point for enchantment is to be likable. And I'm going to give you three key points about starting to be likable. The first thing you need to do is to develop a great smile. This is not a great smile. This is a Pan Am smile. I give this speech fairly often. Like, sometimes the crowd is so young, they never heard of Pan Am. It's scary. I have to explain Pan Am. And I don't want to pick any current airline because that would, you know, create a whole can of worms there. So the smile that she has is the fake smile. It's the only the jaw kind of smile. You know that she's not genuinely happy to see you. So the smile that you really want is called a Duchenne smile. And a Duchenne smile uses two sets of muscles, the jaw and the eyes. And this causes the eyes to sparkle. It also causes the eyes to have wrinkles around it. And so, if nothing else, you will learn tonight that you don't need to spend money on Botox and you don't need to have any plastic surgery. If you want to be enchanting, you actually want crow's feet. Crow's feet, I've never figured out, I don't know if it's crow's feet is good or crow's feet are good, but it is our good. You want crow's feet. And if you look at like George Clooney, look at him smiling, big crow's feet. This is a woman named Marie Smith. She is a social media expert, particularly Facebook, a friend of mine. And I decided to put her picture in my presentation, and I contacted her and I said, Marie, I have good news for you and bad news for you. The good news is I'm going to tell thousands of people about you and what you do and about your great smile. The bad news is I'm putting you in my presentation for thousands of people because you have really pronounced crow's feet. The next thing you need to do is to dress for a tie. I'm going to make this work better. So dressing for a tie means that there's basically three philosophies of dressing. First, you could underdress. You know, everybody's in a coat, but you're wearing T-shirt, jeans, and jogging shoes. It's because you think you're so powerful, you can get away with anything you want. You can also overdress. And what people will take from this is that, oh, this person thinks he's richer than me, he has better taste than me, he's superior to me, he has airs about himself. What you really want to do for an audience is equal dress, to tell the audience that we are basically peers. There is no distance between the two of us. So that's point two in likability. Point three in likability is the perfect handshake. And because we are in Silicon Valley, this is the formula for the perfect handshake. You are to memorize this formula. There will be a quiz afterwards. Basically, you want eye contact, good verbal greeting, smooth, dry hand, not too long, not too short, Duchenne smile, the perfect handshake. You would be surprised. You may be saying to yourself, well, Doug, I knew about the perfect handshake, and I knew about adequate dress or appropriate dress, and I knew about a great smile. The fact remains, though, that most people do not do all three. That's the key to starting likability. Now, you can be likable, but not trustworthy. Right, you can like Hollywood celebrities, but not trust them. You know, at an extreme, you might like Charlie Sheen, but you don't trust Charlie Sheen, for example. So let's work on trustworthiness. First thing, there is a definite order in the flow of trust. It is you trust other people, then they will trust you. It is not a chicken or the egg question. There is a definite order. You have to trust first. Here are three examples. Amazon.com trusts you. When you buy a Kindle book, you have up to 5 days to return that book for full credit. It's trusting you. When you buy Zappos shoes, you can get it at home, try it. If you don't like it, send it back. They will pay shipping both ways. If you had told me that the model for Zappos would be enabling women to buy shoes without trying them on, I would have told you you're crazy. No woman would buy a shoe this way. Well, clearly Zappos has proven me wrong, and it's because women trust it, and women trust it because it trusted women. And the last example, the brick-and-mortar example, is, of course, Nordstrom, famous for trusting its customers. So the order is, if you trust people, they will trust you. The second point of trustworthiness is that you need to become a baker, not an eater. A baker sees the world very differently from an eater. When an eater sees a pie, the eater thinks, limited pie, what I eat, the other person doesn't eat. What the other person eats, I don't eat. It is a zero-sum game pie. A baker sees the world completely differently. A baker sees the world as, I can bake more pies. I can bake bigger pies. The world is not a zero-sum game. Everybody can win. The rising tide floats all boats. People who are bakers are trustworthy. And the final thing is to default to a yes attitude. This means that when you meet people, you should always be thinking, how can I help the person? Which is very different than thinking, how can the person help me? You need to pay it forward. You need to score points on the karmic board in the sky. Default to yes. When you meet people tonight, think, how can I help the person? Not how the person can help me. Three keys to trustworthiness. The next thing is to actually get ready. And the first thing you can do to get ready is to produce a great product or a great service. These are the five qualities of a great product or service. First, depth. Lots of features, lots of functionality. It can do lots of things. Second is intelligence. When you look at this product, you look at this service, you have a sense that the person or the company who created it understood your pain, understood what you needed, perhaps even better than yourself. I will give you a real-world example. I have two teenage boys, 15 and 17. One has a license, one is getting a license. And I want to buy a Mustang. particular Mustang, a GT500 Shelby Mustang. A GT500 Shelby Mustang has 550 horsepower, which is roughly 500 horsepower more than a Prius. And it is a very fast car, viciously fast car. But one of the things that makes me hesitate about buying this car is that inevitably there will be a circumstance where my teenage boys will have to drive it. And the thought of me giving them a car that has 550 horsepower is socially irresponsible. And so I hesitate to do this, and then I found out that Ford has a very intelligent product called the MyKey. And what the MyKey enables you to do is to program the top speed of the car into the key. So I could give my sons the key to the car programmed to 55 miles an hour. Tell me that is not an intelligent product. The C stands for complete. That is to define your product or service in terms of the full spectrum of everything it provides. If you're in the software business, it's not just the software. It's the software and the developers and the support and the documentation and the conferences and the forums. All those great things make up a complete product. Empowering products make you feel more powerful, more creative, more productive. They give you peace of mind. And finally, great products are elegant. Someone cared about the user interface. So if you want to create a great product, just think, are you rolling the dicey? Are you doing something that's deep, intelligent, complete, empowering, and elegant? The next thing you do is to position this product, this service, in your mind with short, sweet, and swallowable description. 3-4 words. 5 words. Not 50 words. Not using industry acronyms. This is an example of a short, sweet, and swallowable ad that an ad agency called Corey K created after 9/11. If you see something, say something. It's like loose lips sink ships. You know, not a mission statement, not 50 words that's good for the shareholders, the employees, the customers, and if you're in Palo Alto, the whales and the dolphins. If you see something, say something. Next thing you do is you conduct a pre-mortem as opposed to a post-mortem. A post-mortem obviously happens after something fails. Typically, it's not so useful because many of the people are gone. If nothing else, they're hostile. It's just not very useful. A pre-mortem is completely the opposite. The way a pre-mortem works is you assemble the team and you say, let's pretend that our product failed. Now let's come up with reasons why it failed. Too many bugs. Poor sales force. Poor support. Microsoft entered the market and gave away the same product. You know, whatever it is. And now let's go through the list and try to eliminate all those reasons in advance so that it never happens that we have a post-mortem. The benefit of this is that it's less emotional. You know, it's one thing to say to the group, pretend that we failed, now come up with hypothetical reasons. It's quite another to say, does anybody have any feedback? Because when you ask that question, people will hesitate. You don't want to be perceived as a naysayer. You know, if you're the marketing person and you know the software has too many bugs, you don't want to say the software is crappy because you know that, you know, you've just created an enemy with the engineering manager. You're seen as a naysayer, a laggard, a Luddite, you know, whatever it is. Why take that career risk? But when the rules are different and everything is open season, come up with any reason why we could fail, it's a very, very productive meeting. The next thing to do is actually launch. The key to a great launch is you tell a story. Why did you create this product? Why did you create this service? And not because you want to buy a 15,000 square foot home and never furnish it. It's because, you know, your wife wanted to sell art online. It's because, you know, you were frustrated that the only place you could use a computer was at a bank or a university, and you thought people should have their own computers. They should have personal computers. Or you saw that search results weren't that great, so you knew there had to be a better way to search, so you created a search engine. These are the kinds of stories that intrigue people. It's personal stories. You know, for a venture capitalist, I think the richest vein for a tech startup is two people in a garage creating the product that they themselves want to use. That's very different from saying, well, we read this industry report, and according to this industry report, you know, security software will be a $100 billion market by the year 2020, and we didn't know anything about security software, but it looked like a big market, and how hard is it to get 1% of a, you know, $100 billion market, so we created security software. That's not a story, okay? A personal story. The second thing is plant many seeds. There are two theories of marketing. One is top-down. Top-down marketing means you identify the A-listers, the analysts, the journalists, the powerful people from the New York Times, Wall Street Journal, Business Week, Fortune, Forbes, CNET, and Wired. You suck up to those people. You suck up to those people because you hope they'll try your product. They'll like your product. They'll bless your product. They'll tell the great unwashed masses and hoi polloi, you should try this product. You should use this product. We have decreed it from up on the mountain. In that scenario, you suck up to those people or you hire a PR firm to suck up for you. Then the PR firm assigns an Oriental art history from Wellesley, who has never used a computer before, to do the sucking up for you. So, but that's a whole different story. We won't go down that path. My theory is marketing 2.0. Marketing 2.0 in a world of social media means the world is flat. And it's inverted. Inverted means that, you know, it is probably Lonely Boy 15 and Tiffany Girl 65 on Facebook or on Twitter. And these people love your product, and they have very few followers, but they're very vocal, and they convince their peers to use the product. And one day you wake up, and my God, lots of people are using our product. I never heard of any of them. They didn't get this blessing from the Wall Street Journal or the New York Times. They just used it because they loved it. And you wake up one day, and you're a Twitter. Okay? Now, it is not the case that when a famous journalist saw Twitter for the first time, they decreed that Twitter would be successful. You find me the article that said, I saw Twitter, and Twitter is the future. People are wanting to send out 140-character messages. They want to tell the whole world that their cat rolled over, or the line at Pete's is long. You know, that, and someday I predict that Twitter is going to bring down totalitarian regimes all over the world. You know, that conversation never took place. The way it works is Lonely Boy 15 loves your product, tells his 25 followers, who tell their 25 followers. One day you wake up, you're successful, and then the A-listers and the great powerful oracles of our day have to cover you, because if they don't cover you, they look clueless. You're going to stress me out if you keep holding that sign on. The next key point is to use salient points. On the left side, you see sort of the industry jargon. Miles per gallon. What really people care about is cost per year. Degrees on your thermostat. What really people care about is heating costs. Gigabytes. What people really care about is number of songs. Do any of you wake up in the morning saying, if only I had 64 gigabytes. You know? You wake up thinking, I want cool, powerful, lots of songs, lots of movies, lots of books. That's what you want. You need to talk to people in terms of the number of songs, the salient points. The next thing is to overcome resistance. This is a picture of depicting, that's kind of a redundant term, overcoming resistance. This is a Nintendo system, and it was called the Family Computer System. It was introduced at a time where electronic games was a tarnished market in the United States. It had a very difficult time getting retailers to carry this. So what it did is it added a robot to the game and called it a toy, because retailers were okay with stocking toys, but not games. And then it called this an educational toy, so that kids would ask their parents for Christmas for an educational toy, not a game. More ways to overcome resistance. First of all, provide social proof. Make it easy for other people to see that lots of people use this. When the iPod came out, everybody was using this thing with white earbuds all of a sudden. What were white earbuds? iPods. So you got the message, lots of people are using iPods, must be good, I'll buy an iPod too. So now there were more white earbuds to provide social proof. Make social proof easy. Second way to overcome resistance is to find a bright spot. You will encounter resistance, but in all that resistance, there's probably one or two bright spots. For Apple, we tried to make Macintosh a spreadsheet database and word processing machine. It was 0 for 3 there. The bright spot was Aldous PageMaker. Created a really bright spot called desktop publishing, and desktop publishing saved Apple. No desktop publishing, no Apple. Today would be a different world. We'd all have phones with real keyboards. We would have phones with batteries that lasted for more than a day. Or we wouldn't be stuck with AT&T. It would be a different world. This is a picture of Vietnam, because in Vietnam, one person found a bright spot to fight malnutrition. He found that in every village, there were some families that had healthier kids. And the only difference in their behavior was that they added shrimps and crabs from the rice paddies to their meals. That was the bright spot in all this Vietnamese malnutrition, that some families did this, and he trained the other families to also do it. The next thing is to enchant all the influencers. Do not assume it's the CXO. Many people assume it's the CXO or the husband. All right, I'll tell you, in the business sense, the problem with assuming that it's the CXO that makes the call and is the most powerful, intelligent person, the purchasing decision person, is this. The higher you go in most organizations, the thinner the air. The thinner the air, the more difficult it is to support intelligent life. So as you go higher and higher in most organizations, you start dealing with dumber and dumber people. Truly, the work and the intelligence of most organizations is in the middle and the bottom. So don't focus on the CXO level. In the family case, don't assume it's the father. It could be the mother. Could be the sister-in-law. Could be the grandfather. And in my family, it's the daughter. My 9-year-old daughter is my key influencer. If you get her to do something or tell me to do something, it's done. I'll do anything for my daughter. I'll go to Justin Bieber movie if I have to. Speaking of Justin Bieber movie, I want to encourage all of you to go to Never Say Never. You may think I'm nuts, but Never Say Never is a great movie about marketing. You will learn lots about marketing in Never Say Never. You'll learn how hard Justin Bieber works. You'll learn how he interacts with his vocal coach, a very good example of mentoring. You'll see that he has a crew that goes out into the parking lots of concerts and gives tickets to girls who don't have tickets and the joy they bring to those girls. And it's just, I learned a lot about marketing by watching Never Say Never. If any of you go to it and you don't learn something, I will give you your money back. I promise you. Go see that movie. The next thing is to make your enchantment endure. We're going to go from Justin Bieber to Grateful Dead. That's a transition. The Grateful Dead, highly enduring music group. One of the ways it endures is because it has a place at every concert for what's called tapers, although nobody uses tape anymore. And basically, they are encouraging people to record the music and then distribute it to their friends. This gives heart attacks to the RIAA. The RIAA suing little old ladies. The Grateful Dead is encouraging you to record their music, to spread it out, to make them endure. More ways to make yourself endure. First of all, do not rely on money. I'm not saying you shouldn't pay people reasonably, but when you introduce money into the equation of enchantment, you make it very complex. The person who is being enchanted is going to ask the logical question, are you telling me to do this because it's good for me or it's because it's good for you? Are you on commission? Do you have an affiliate fee? The very person who's doing the enchantment is going to rightfully ask himself or herself, am I doing this for the money or am I doing this because I truly believe? Do not rely on money to enchant people. Second thing is invoke reciprocation. This is a carpet that depicts the war between Ethiopia and Italy. When Italy invaded Ethiopia, the people of Mexico collected money and sent money to help the Ethiopians. 85 years later, when there was an earthquake in Mexico, the people in Ethiopia collected money and sent money to the Mexicans. And this is because of reciprocation. And at the time, Ethiopia was going through a famine. So it's not like they were fat, dumb, and happy and could just write checks. They were in a very bad way. Fast forward to another example. Right after the Civil War, the people of New York bought the people of Charleston, South Carolina, a fire truck when they heard that they were using a bucket brigade to fight fires. Fast forward to the 9/11, and right after 9/11, the people of Charleston, some 150 years later, collected $500,000 and bought the people of New York a fire truck. Because at the time of the Civil War, they vowed that if New York ever needed Charleston's help, Charleston would come through. It took 150 years, but they did come through. Two power tips about reciprocation. First of all, when you do something for somebody and they thank you, the optimal response is not just you're welcome, but I know you would do the same for me. What I'm telling you is I know you're an honorable person. I know you would do the same for me. The other thing I'm telling you is I know you would do the same for me. Just so you know, I know you do. Second thing about reciprocation is enable people to pay you back. You know, you may think, oh, just let it go. Don't worry about it. She doesn't have to pay me back. You're actually doing both of yourselves a disservice. She's carrying around this load of obligation and reciprocation. She has no opportunity to pay you back. She'd like to ask you to do more things, but she can't. She feels bad. She already owes you something. Let her pay you back. Then you can clear the decks and you can have more transactions. You can have more favors going back and forth. Enabling people to pay you back is a gift. You know, don't not to give the gift. The next point is to build an ecosystem. An ecosystem means all the stuff that's around yourself or your company or your service, all the other parties that want to support you so that you are successful. This ecosystem of developers. Think of all the app developers for the iPhone. They're making Apple endure. All the app developers for Android, they're making Android endure. You want this ecosystem around you. Seventh point is to learn to really pitch and present and speak well. First key point, customize the introduction. It means that, you know, you're not giving this canned speech. You're doing something different, something special. This is a picture of two LG appliances. I was in South America. I was in Brazil, actually, giving a speech to the management of Latin America LG. When I got there, I saw that, I thought that, you know, God, you're so stupid. You have an LG washer and dryer. You have the LG washer. You bought that washer because it has a steam cycle. You have never used the steam cycle, but it was so cool. You bought the LG washer, and you should show a picture of your LG washer to the LG management team in Brazil so that they, like, you know, have this close and warm and fuzzy feeling about you. But I was already in Brazil, so I sent a text message to my two boys, the same two boys I wouldn't let, you know, drive a Mustang. And I said, you know, this is Dad. I need pictures of our washer and dryer. Go downstairs and take a picture. You know, this is your father, the one that bought you each an iPhone. Go downstairs and take a picture. So a few hours go by, nothing happens. So I send a follow-up text message to my older son, Nick. And, you know, I basically, well, here you can see the transaction. I say to Nick, did you get my text messages, bozo? He answers back, Noah, his other brother, said he did the pictures. By the way, while you're talking to LG, can you get us some TVs? You know, because he's tired of playing Call of Duty and Halo on a small TV. He needs a 60-inch plasma thin high-definition TV to play Call of Duty. And then you see my response, which is, I doubt it, because, you know, there is reciprocation and there is stupidity. The point here is customize the introduction. Second thing is sell your dream. When you try to make something last, you don't say that I have a new iPhone. It's $188 worth of parts. It's assembled in China. It's kind of a tricky company. People commit suicide at that company, but $188 of parts manufactured in China. And we stick you with this two-year contract for arguably the worst data network in the world, AT&T. That's not exactly how Steve Jobs positions an iPhone. He positions an iPhone as power and coolness, and there's an app for that, and all the good stuff, thinness, all that beautiful stuff. He's selling a dream of a great phone. He's not positioning it as parts, labor, and a data contract. Next point is the 10-20-30 rule of PowerPoint. You should optimally use 10 slides in a PowerPoint presentation. 10. That's all the human mind can handle. 10. 10 key points. Now, some of you may be thinking, I know what you're thinking. You're thinking, you know, Guy, you've used way more than 10 slides already, right? Well, let me explain. There's two explanations for this. First of all, you're not me. Secondly, I like to use builds, and I like to use builds with lots of pictures. So I could have 10 slides with 3 points each and just click, click, and click. But really, I want 3 different slides to explain 3 different points. The next thing is you should be able to give these 10 slides in 20 minutes. You have an hour. That is true. But 95% of the world uses Windows laptops. That 95% of the world needs 40 minutes to make the laptop work at the projector. Okay? 10 slides, 20 minutes. And the optimal font size is 30 points. The rule of thumb is find who the oldest person is in the audience, divide his or her age by 2. You're pitching to 50-year-old people, 25 points. 60-year-old people, 30 points. You know, VCs are getting younger, managers are getting younger, boards of directors are getting younger. Someday you may be pitching to a 16-year-old VC. At that point, God bless you, use an 8-point font. Okay? But until that day, 10 slides, 20 minutes, 30-point font. Next point in Chapman is how to use technology. First of all, remove the speed bumps to your technology. Move the speed bumps to using your service, your product. This is an example of a speed bump. This is a system called CAPTCHA. What it does is it makes you, as a human, enter in those two words so that you prove you're not a robot. Okay? So, no problem with the first word. More or less, it must be Holber. It's the second word. What is that word? It's Hebrew. Or maybe it's Farsi. Or maybe it's Katakana. Or Korean. Or I don't know what. Simple Chinese. Complex Chinese. I don't know what it is. Even if I knew what it is, unlikely I have the keyboard that I can enter that word. Right? That's a speed bump. Remove the speed bump. Secondly, generally speaking, on social media, if you're not a celebrity, if you are a celebrity, if you're Lance Armstrong, God bless you, tweet that your bike had a flat tire in Paris. Okay, that's interesting. If you're Shaquille O'Neal, tweet that you just bought a black Prius. Okay, that's interesting. But the rest of us, we need to be tweeting useful information or analysis or insights or assistance. That's what makes social media interesting when you add value like this. And the last point is the rules of engagement. First of all, you need to engage fast. Respond within 24 or 48 hours. This is a goal. I don't reach this goal myself. But if you want to be digitally enchanting, one of the very easiest ways is to answer quickly. A second way is to engage many people. Again, plant many seeds. Not just the A-listers, but if LonelyBoy15 writes to you, write back. Because LonelyBoy15 may be the person that makes you tip. And the last thing is, you have to do it often. Social media, Twitter, Facebook, email is not something you do when everything else is done. It's core to functionality. It is not contextual to functionality. Ninth point, how to enchant your boss. The most painful part of this presentation. Truly the way to enchant your boss is drop everything else when your boss says to do something. This also applies to wives. You want to enchant your wife? When your wife asks you to do something, drop everything else. The best secret. It's not palatable. It may not be optimal for your organization, but this is what works. Drop everything when your boss asks you to do something. And then prototype fast. If your boss asks you to create a PowerPoint presentation in a week, the next day show up with an outline. This is the outline for this presentation. This has two good effects. One is it shows you're on top of things. You came right back with a prototype. Second good effect is that it increases the probability that your presentation will be right, because you have lots more time to work on it, because you've given your boss a very quick way to give you feedback. Next point is deliver bad news early. There will be bad news. You should never surprise your boss with bad news. The earlier your boss hears about the bad news, the better it is. Even better would be bad news with a solution. The 10th point in enchanting is enchanting employees who work for you. Key point here is to provide what I call a map. A map has three components. First, mastery. If you work for me, I will enable you to master new skills. You will become a better employee. You'll master social media. You'll master programming or writing or photography or whatever you do. It's a path for you to not only work, but gain skills. You'll be working autonomously. I'm not going to micromanage you. And we have a higher purpose here. We're not simply trying to make a buck. We're trying to make the world a better place. So your pitch to an employee is, come work for me. You'll learn new skills. You'll be working independently. And you'll be working on something with a high purpose. Next way to enchant people who work for you is to empower them, to say to them, I think you're right. I think you have good judgment. Make the right decision for our customer. And the third way is to suck it up, which means that you never ask an employee to do something that you yourself would not do. That be like Mike Rowe. How many of you watch Dirty Jobs? Dirty Jobs is a great show. Mike Rowe goes all over the world and he does like the dirtiest jobs, cleans out sewers, you know, exterminates rats, changes power lines. He went to Hawaii and he made poi. He cleaned the outside of a skyscraper. He does all this cool stuff. The thing that's enchanting about Mike Rowe is he sucks it up. He does the dirty job. You should be a boss who is willing and has done the dirty job. That's very enchanting. And then, this is my last slide because is this not 30 minutes? Huh? Perfect, right? You see that? This is my last slide. This slide has two pieces of information. I like to give credit to the person who created my slides. It's a woman named Anna Frizal, a good Brazilian woman. And that is her website. And if you want copies of this presentation, just drop an email to gina@garage.com. And so that, in 30 minutes, is the art of enchantment. So remember, enchantment is a process. It's a process of building on a base of likability and trustworthiness with a great product, with a great service. Three good examples to keep in mind. Think of the product quality of Apple. Think of the trustworthiness of Zappos. And think of the likability of Virgin and Richard Branson. When I first met Richard Branson in Moscow, we were at a conference where we both were speaking. And he asked me if I flew on Virgin. And I said, I never fly on Virgin, Richard, because I'm a United Airlines Global Services level. It's the highest level of United. I don't want to jeopardize that. And so he just got down on his knees and he started polishing my shoes with his coat. And from that day forward, I started flying Virgin America. So remember, the likability of Richard Branson, the product of Apple Computer, the trustworthiness of Zappos, and you too will be an enchanting person or company, product or service. Thank you very much. Thank you very much.
Guy Kawasaki for his presentation on enchantment marketing. We will be taking that to learn how to enchant you, our audience, and our members starting tomorrow, starting right now. But before we get there, I'm going to welcome Josh McHugh. He's the CEO of Attention Span Media. He is the president of the Inforum Board of Directors, a contributing writer for Vanity Fair, and he's here to interview Guy Kawasaki post-presentation and pre-year questions. So tune in really soon. We'll be asking your questions. Please join me in welcoming Josh McHugh.
Thanks a lot, Caroline. Guy, going to ask you a bunch of questions about your book.
Okay.
But before that, I wanted to remind our radio listeners that this program is presented by the Commonwealth Club's Inforum. Tonight we're hosting the absolutely legendary VC evangelist.
You forgot who you're talking to for a
moment. No, no. It was the title of the book. It was in the script as enchantment marketing rather than
if we have time, I'm going to tell you a great Jackie Chan story.
All right. Well, we've got plenty of time. Yeah. Let's get into the book. So, as I looked at this, it was kind of funny because there's been so much literature over the years that's a lot more, let's say, Machiavellian, about how to get ahead and how to succeed.
Swimming with sharks,
all that kind of stuff. Going through this book, it was really interesting, and especially because you're a VC, I'm an entrepreneur, and
Where this is going.
I'm not going to pitch you, don't worry, but you do hear a lot of stories, and in recent years you've had Sean Parker and those guys doing the Founders Fund and a sort of like a pushback on VC. So the question is, have people, your peers sort of called you out and said, come on, man, you can't be this nice to everybody. It just doesn't scale,
This is going to come out wrong, but it's not, you're going to laugh when I say this, but it's not meant in a funny way, but I don't have peers in the VC business. And by that, it's not because I'm superior to them. It's because I just have a very different perspective on life. And I don't particularly like the venture capital business. 99.9% of the time you're saying no. And that, tenth of a percent of the time when you say yes, you're going to have to beat the crap out of the CEO in a year. Because the CEO came in and he had this PowerPoint presentation and he said, roughly, this is how it goes. There are 300 million Americans. One in four owns a dog. That means 75 million dogs. Each dog eats two cans of dog food per day. That's 150 million cans of dog food per day. How hard could it be to get just 1% of that market? That would be 1.5 million cans of dog food per day. You make $2 per dog food can. That's $3 million per day. And this is a 365-day-a-year business because dogs don't take the weekend off and stop eating. So it's 365 million times $3 million a day. Conservatively speaking, worst case, we're going to do $1 billion in the first year. Is that how your pitch went?
Absolutely. Every time.
So the reason why, I'm kind of the anti-VC VC. I'm barely a VC. I think, honestly, a venture capitalist is less necessary today than ever. And you know, you're probably relieved because if you look at it, you know, look at the fundamental things that you need. You need tools, but with open source, basically every tool is free. You need marketing, but if you use Facebook and Twitter and blogs well, you don't need to pay for marketing. You need infrastructure, like servers and stuff, but now you can call up Amazon or Rackspace and you can pay $1,000 a month and get terabytes of data. So now you don't need a server room. You need people, but in a recession, people are cheap or free. Kind of Machiavellian for me to say that, but it's the truth. So people are free or cheap. You might need commercial office space, and commercial office space is cheap, but really you don't really need any commercial office space because your team is virtual anyway. So now, you know, we're running out of stuff we need to fund. We don't need marketing money. We don't need tools money. We don't need commercial real estate money. We don't need infrastructure money. You could start a company for a lot less money these days. Life is good for an entrepreneur.
All right. Good answer. makes me feel great. Was looking at Twitter today, and there's an investor and an ex-Googler, Chris Sacca, who he said one thing he just tweeted out, didn't seem to be quoting anybody, but he said, nothing jeopardizes innovation more than the desire to be liked by everyone. So I wonder sort of what you thought about that sentiment about sort of consensus gathering versus single-minded focus on innovation.
You know, probably that person is fully vested and rich. I think that's I don't know the context of how he said that. But in one sense, I agree that if you try to make a product that appeals to everybody, you'll appeal to nobody. Right, so if you're Toyota and you make a Scion XB, you are appealing to a 25-year-old with a golden retriever and a surfboard. You're not trying to appeal to a 56-year-old with four kids. So the Scion XB is for the surfer dude with the mountain bike and the surfboard. The Sienna is for, you know, 56-year-old with four kids. If you tried to create a car that was good for four kids and for the surfer dude, you would end up with mediocrity. So from that standpoint, I understand what he's saying, that, you know, with product design, you pick a niche. You know, Justin Bieber appeals to girls who are 9 to 14. You know, hallelujah, I'd like to dominate that niche the way he does. But, you know, he doesn't appeal to... How many of you have seen the movie? Okay, one person. How many of you have been to a Justin Bieber concert? There's no negative numbers in the audience. Okay, so, you know, basically, if Justin Bieber said, I want to appeal to Commonwealth Club and Trixie and Tiffany and Biff, you know, he wouldn't be Justin Bieber. So so in that sense, I agree with him. On the other hand, one cannot have too many friends. You know, like, it's just so much easier to live life not to be popular for the sake of being popular, but to live life as a mensch and to live life ethically and to live life with, you know, not a zero-sum game attitude and to live life honestly. I mean, I have a really pragmatic reason for being honest. It's just a lot easier to be honest because if you lie, you really have to keep track of your lies. Like, what did I tell the Commonwealth Club? What did I tell, you know, Fortune? I had four meetings today. I met with Fortune. I met with the business school. I'm meeting with you guys, and I had an interview. So if I was telling lies, I'd have to keep, just today, I'd have to keep four sets of lies straight. And I'm 56 years old. I can barely keep, you know, one thing straight. And so, you know, my whole case against lying is, it's just a lot easier to tell the truth because there is only one truth. So much easier to keep straight.
All right.
You're looking at me like I'm nuts. But,
No. I'm looking at you like that does sound a lot simpler, and there should be a software solution for people who need to lie on a regular basis just to keep a database of all their lies. So you mentioned menschiness, or being a mensch, and that is
the highest form of praise.
Yeah, the way you talk about it in here, it's like a leadership style versus, you know, again, like a more Machiavellian thing where you play people off against each other, you make them afraid of you, all that stuff. Can you just talk a little bit about menschiness?
Mensch is a German word, but it's really in the Jewish Israeli sense of the word that I use it, and it represents a person who is trustworthy, honest, has the other person's best interest at heart. The highest form of praise is if someone calls you a mensch. And this is one of those words that it's very hard to take the word and define it in English terms. Maybe somebody out here can do it better for me, but one should always aspire to be a mensch. That is clearly, you know, the best. And it's very difficult to find examples of mensches. I think probably the most visible mensch is Nelson Mandela. I would say Nelson Mandela is a mensch. I can't think of another one right now that would be. Perhaps Jimmy Carter. Jimmy Carter became more mensch-like after the presidency than while he was a president. So,
All right. I think we've got maybe 5 minutes before the audience gets a crack.
Okay.
So wanted to hit one more thing at least before we go to the audience questions. Mm-hmm. In the book, you draw a real distinction between these two different methodologies of getting things done. These two very different approaches. There's one that is focused on, and you hear this mantra a lot, even now, engage the influencers, right?
Okay.
And that's sort of the tipping point based point
tipping
of view,
point
right?
As in Malcolm Gladwell?
As in Malcolm Gladwell.
Yeah.
And then you've got the, I think it's Duncan Watts, right?
Right.
Viewpoint saying, no.
Right.
You know, that's not it at all. And then you've got the nobodies are the new somebodies.
Right.
I love that part of it. And it seems to go against a lot of what you read day to day on the blogs about engaging influencers, here's how you find them, all that.
So Malcolm Gladwell has this theory of these mass influencers that if you got to the right people, they make your product tip. Duncan Watts is a person who works for Yahoo, and he believes, more like I do, that Lonely Boy 15 and a bunch of Lonely Boys makes a product tip. So I am definitely in the Duncan Watt camp. In fact, my writing cites his works because that's where I got the idea. Honestly, part of being a writer is you need to know what to steal. And that is a skill in and of itself, because you could break into a house and steal the pillows, right? I mean, you need to know to take the LCD TV. But anyway, that's a different discussion. So my theory, based on what I've seen with Twitter and Facebook and things like that, is it wasn't because these key influencers did it. It was because Lonely Boy 15 did it. And so, I practice what I preach. Typically, when you ship a business book, you send it to roughly 200 people, Washington Post, New York Times, Book Review, the major business bloggers, Wired, CNET, those kind of things. And you basically send it out and you pray that they review your book. I did quite the opposite. I sent it out to those 200 people too. Don't get me wrong. I'm not saying you ignore the A-listers, but I also sent it out to 1,400 bloggers. And these bloggers, I don't know if they have 5,000 page views a day or 5 page views a day, but any blogger that asked, I sent a book. And so now, there are about 220 reviews of this book existing today, 16 days after the book came out, which is a lot of book reviews. And let me tell you something. Some of it is in these, huge publications. But I'll tell you, you can find a lot of book reviews that's in Kim's beauty blog. And Kim is I can never pronounce this word right. Kim is a esthetician. Is that how you say that? Okay, so Kim is an esthetician, and she usually writes about makeup and mascara and, I don't know, extending your eyeliners, or I don't know, whatever. But she reviewed my book. And there's another guy who's a dog trainer, and he reviewed my book. And so I'm thinking, you know, if Kim, the esthetician, says, well, usually I write about mascara and I tell you how to be beautiful on the outside, but I just read a book who will help you become enchanting and beautiful on the inside. Hallelujah, man. Praise God. I mean, you know, if all the estheticians in the world bought this book, you know, hey, I could buy a Mustang for both sons. So, I mean, really, that is my theory. I think you should plant many seeds. I really do.
All right. One more quick question.
Okay.
The amount you talk about how to use tech tools and uh-huh. how to use push technology, how to use pull tools. You are known on Twitter for sending a lot of tweets.
I know where this is going. Yeah.
A lot of tweets.
Yeah.
And I mean, it's, you know, it doesn't look like it's hurting your follower count, but I know that a lot of people sort of have a threshold.
Some people hate me.
Does that bother you, or have you ever scaled back on it, or
not at all? So this, just so you know, the full story. So I use Twitter as a marketing platform. For me, it's not social media; it's marketing media. And it throws me off here. So it's a marketing platform. So I'm trying to get more followers, because the more followers you have on Twitter, the more powerful it is. And so I sort of have an NPR model in my mind. And the NPR model is I push out such great content, links to stuff that you would never find. I found it for you. Or I have, believe it or not, 21 contributors who contribute to my Twitter account. So we have 21 smart people looking for good stuff all the time. I'm always trying to find you good content. So I'm trying to earn this, that this feeling of, you know, enchantment and reciprocation, so that once every 4 years when I come out with a book, believe me, I am going to promote my book through Twitter. All right, so the NPR model is you listen to NPR, you listen to Fresh Air, Tech Nation, Wait, Don't Tell Me, This American Life, you know, this show, you listen to all this great stuff. So guess what? A couple times a year, they run a telethon and they run fundraising. And you have to say to yourself, well, it's okay that they do that, because I get such joy out of This American Life and Fresh Air and Wait, Don't Tell Me, that they have earned the right to promote to me. I'm trying to earn the right to promote. I run my tweets, I repeat them 4 times, 8 hours apart. This is because I don't assume people scroll back through the timeline and find old tweets. They just come to Twitter and they look at what's on. It's like when you go to CNN. How many of you TiVo CNN? Right? So you go back and say, oh, so what did TNN report on 12 hours ago? Just let me, you know, roll back TiVo. What was CNN? No, you turn CNN on, and if it's the Michael Jackson funeral, you watch the Michael Jackson funeral. That same sequence ran half an hour ago. Right. CNN doesn't assume you're on CNN 24/7 or TiVoing it. I don't assume you're on Twitter 24/7 and rolling back. And if you sat at your computer and saw my tweet repeat, by definition, it means that you sat at your computer 8 hours. You are on your computer too much. This is not my fault.
Take a walk.
It's not my fault.
Take
you
a
need
walk
a life.
Around.
Yeah.
Oh, man. Well, on the topic of getting up, we should. And I'm sure we've got some folks here with some questions.
Have at it.
That they want to ask. And so please start lining up at the two mics here. If you do have questions, and
all right.
Before we start with the questions, I just want to remind our radio audience that the program is presented by the Commonwealth Club's Inforum Division, and tonight we're hosting Guy Kawasaki, who's got a new book out called Enchantment. That's really fantastic, not just for people who want to know how to go through a business cycle or launch a startup, but honestly, for just dealing with people in life, whether you're profit, nonprofit, or just being.
In a sense, I want enchantment to be to personal relations what In Search of Excellence was to business, that it changed people's expectations of what was possible.
All right.
Hey, guys, is that your butterfly?
This is my butterfly.
Do you mind sharing that story with
us? Okay, sure.
And I have one question on that.
Okay.
Did you get to experience the artist's flow in his process?
No. So here's the story with this butterfly. I ran a crowdsource contest for the cover of my book, and it came back with a the cover that I liked was a red cover with a blue Morpho stock photo from a site called DeviantArt. So it was a stock photo that anybody could have used, public domain photo. And I sent this cover design to my publisher, and my publisher said, you know, guy, this design is too feminine, it's too self-help, it's too woo-woo, it's too Marin, it's too Boulder, it's too Shirley MacLaine, it's too crystals, too pyramid, too est. So, you know, no real man is going to buy a book with a blue butterfly on a red cover. So I was disappointed because I liked the concept of a butterfly, metamorphosis, you know, all that good stuff. And so, but then I got to thinking, you know, I'm Japanese, so guess what? There's this thing called origami. I'm Japanese, but I don't know jack about origami. So, I have Google, just like anybody else. So I Google origami butterfly, and I come upon this guy named Michael LaFosse, who is this great origamiist. And if you're into origami, there's a movie called Between the Folds, and he's the first guy that they show on this movie. So I said, wow, this is like, he's the man. He's the Wayne Gretzky of origami. So I get in touch with him, and I convince him that, you know, you should create for me. His famous butterfly design is called a swallowtail, Alexander Swallowtail, after his significant other. And so I convince him, you know, I don't want to have a butterfly that is already somebody's name. I want my own butterfly. So he created this butterfly for me. This is the Kawasaki Swallowtail. And the Kawasaki Swallowtail, first of all, you know, cross this off the bucket list. Have you ever heard of the Zuckerberg Swallowtail? Huh? Have you ever heard of the Jobs Swallowtail, Ellison Swallowtail, Gates Swallowtail, Ballmer Swallowtail? You know, have you? Grove Swallowtail? No, this is the Kawasaki Swallowtail. And if you look at it, it's obviously now on the cover of my book. This Swallowtail is, if you could imagine the unnatural sex act of a blue Morpho mating with a B-1 bomber, this is what the kids would look like. So this is a badass butterfly. And so now I'm happy because I have the butterfly metamorphosis stuff about enchantment, and my publisher's happy because it doesn't look too self-help, you know, woo-woo, crystals, Shirley MacLaine. Everybody's happy.
Question over here.
Question for you. My name is Diane Olberg. I'm a follower of yours on Twitter, and I was so impressed when I followed you that you answered me right away and said, follow this, don't follow that, so that it would be easier for me. I appreciated that. Two things. I want to share with you a Mark Twain quote that goes to your issue about not lying. Mark Twain reportedly said, if you never lie, you never have to remember anything.
That's right.
Which is really good. So my question is your view on publishing. You're publishing a print book.
Mm-hmm.
How you view the technology platforms as affecting publishing, and as a writer, how it affects how you write.
Okay. So I predict that when all the dust settles, roughly 80 or 75% of my books will be sold paper and 25% electronic. My personal use, I have an iPad. And in the last year, I can tell you I bought exactly one hardcover book in paper, which is the Chicago Manual of Style. And I bought the Chicago Manual of Style just as I was finishing my book because, you know, you may find this a slightly weird, but one of the most pleasurable parts of finishing a book is when the final a copy edit, and, you know, and I really am into copy editing. And I do things like, I believe in the serial comma, okay? I mean, that's a religious issue with me. There are people who don't believe in the serial comma, and there are people who do. I believe in the serial comma. I think it's a tragic mistake if you don't have a serial comma. I also hate adjectives and adverbs, you know? Somebody slowly did this? Well, what does slowly mean? How fast was it? You know, give me a number, right? So I hate adverbs. So what I would do is I would search for every word with L-Y in it, and I would search for every that and which. I would, no pun intended, go on a witch hunt, because many times when you use which, you should have used that. So anyway, so part of the pleasure of the final process is using the Chicago Manual style to really, you know, understand, you know, is it 50%, is it the number 50 and percent, or is it the percent sign? And I don't, you know. So anyway, well, you didn't ask about that, but anyway. So, but I have bought roughly 50 books electronically. I read more now than ever because I used to buy hardcover books. When I was at the SFO airport on the way flying out, I bought a book because I needed something to read, right? And so when I finished that book, if I wasn't near SFO airport, or Kepler's in my case, in Menlo Park, I wouldn't buy a book. So now, when I finish a book at 10 o'clock, at 10:15, I'm in another book. I've read probably 5 or 10 times more than I ever... Now, I don't want you to think I'm reading all these great, you know, Isabel Allende kind of books. I'm reading, like, Frustrated Navy SEAL's daughter gets killed by terrorists, and the president calls him up and says, you know, the CIA is incompetent, the FBI is clueless, so I'm creating this special presidential commission. The laws don't apply to you. Here's a pardon in advance. Kill the bad guys. That's my kind of book, okay? Just so you understand. And so, I am obviously personally a big believer in e-books in my own personal consumption. But having said that, like tonight's event, hopefully all of you will go, you know, buy a book and help the Commonwealth Club. Don't worry about me. Help the Commonwealth Club. Yeah, I'm going down on the enchantment scale. I'm losing my menschness. But, you know, at these kinds of events, the paper book that I can autograph is much more powerful, right? And a lot of times a company gives books to its employees at the off-site or at an event. Now, if the world were purely electronically, I mean, what would you do? Would everybody bring their iPad and you get a stylus and sign the book with your iPad? I mean, how would you do it? You know, it's like, okay,
stickers.
Yeah, all your employees, you know, thank you very much for coming. Here's your DVD. I mean, it's just, you know, the magic is gone. So I don't know if we'll go to an all electronic book version. Having said that, if I were a book publisher, I would really be worried because, I'm 50 to 1 in terms of electronic versus paper, personally.
All right. Last question over here.
Sure. Hi, Guy. My name is Cynthia Riddell, and I just graduated from USF. I've been super ambitious my entire life, and I just wanted to thank
you. Your entire life?
Entire life.
How old are you?
22.
Oh, man.
But just to prove that.
I've been senile longer than you've been ambitious.
So out of college, my first job is to be the marketing and sales manager of a software company. And I want to thank you very much for your thoughts and the art of the start. Because it's made a huge difference. Now, I was wondering, because I'm bootstrapping, if you could sign it for me.
Well, what a question. Oh, let me think. No, I cannot.
No way.
I follow you on Twitter, by the way.
Thank you. Thank you. It would be an honor and a privilege to sign it. Thank you. That's not a question, though.
It is a question.
Would you sign my book?
Yes.
That's a good...
By the way... you know, if you support the Commonwealth Club tonight by buying a book, I'm going to autograph it on the cover. Well, unless you tell me the inside. And I'll tell you why I autograph it on the cover. I autograph it on the cover for two reasons. One is it's a lot faster, honestly. And the second reason is, to me, the reason why you get a book autographed is so that you can show your friends and your family. You met the author and you know the person or whatever. So, you know, why hide the autograph on the inside? You want it on the cover. You want it to be the most blatant thing. Now... you'll see that penmanship is not one of my strong points. So what I sign is, resisting you is futile. That's what I'm going to sign, because it's very hard to see what I sign sometimes. That's what it says.
So remember that.
Yeah, remember that. Yeah. Now, I used to sign my books, funny story, I used to sign my books Kick Butt. In fact, you know, most of the books, in fact, you know, I signed so many of my books, someday the unsigned ones are going to be worth a lot of money. But anyway, so I used to sign Art of the Start, Kick Butt, until a woman came up to me and said, Guy, why did you sign my book Nice Butt? So that's the day I stopped signing Kick Butt.
Oh, man. If people ask for that tonight, can they get...
Nice butt?
Nice butt.
Depends what their butt looks like. Because you always have to tell the truth. You know?
Right, right. Yeah, yeah.
I think we better quit there.
All right. One more quick question, hopefully.
Yeah, hi, Guy. We met at South by Southwest. And it's quite funny. I speak Japanese fluently, and you're Japanese in it, you don't. So it was, like, quite interesting. I bought your book. And I bought a big bunch of books, actually. And yeah. I look forward to reading that when I get back. I'm flying out tomorrow. But my question is, how would you compare your marketing of a book to Tim Ferriss, for example? Because he's also awesome. You're also awesome. Slightly different ways. How would you compare? And what exactly do you do? Like,
you know, Tim Ferriss talks a lot about having the 1 week long orgasm. I don't cover that subject in my book.
The 4 hour orgasm, right?
Tim Ferriss is a friend of mine. And, you know, I think we probably have similar approaches to marketing book. It's all about grassroots. It's all about getting, you know, Lonely Boy 15 to love the book. And, he's big in social media. I think we pretty much see eye to eye there. You know, as opposed to the, let's hope the New York Times blesses it and, you know, people read it. I think South by Southwest, by the way, I love, South by Southwest is the best conference of the year. I just love,
Red Eye.
Listen, I'm a big Mac guy, and Macworld Expo used to be so great over here in Moscone. Without Apple there, it's a very different thing. So I think, you know, when I die, I'll probably get cremated. I'll have my ashes spread in Austin because I don't want to ever miss a South.
Not
by
Japan.
Southwest.
Not Japan.
Very cool.
All right.
One more thing before we wrap it up. What we've taken to doing is giving each of our esteemed guests 60 seconds to fix the world.
So fix the world.
In 60 seconds, what would your master plan be to change the world for the better?
Wow. How political do I dare get?
Go for it.
So,
tell the truth.
Okay, we'll really go for it. I may lose a few book sales here, but, you know, I got to say that right now, there are moments that I'm not that proud to be an American. There are moments that I just like, you know, why is it that we think that we should go bomb all these countries? I don't understand that. I don't understand why we think that, you know, we should go and interfere. And I don't understand this diplomacy by cruise missile and Tomahawk missile. It's not a very enchanting thing. It's hard to imagine, you know, getting a Tomahawk missile up your butt is enchanting. And what you know, I just ask myself, it's a very good test, you know. So let's say that there are riots in Los Angeles, okay? You know, black guy got beat up by cops, so all these riots. And so there's all these riots, so the government of the U.S., you know, they start shutting down the riots and, you know, police force and all that. So someone in Paris or somebody in Russia says, oh, my God, you know, human atrocities, the U.S. government is terrorizing its people. We need to go and enforce a no-fly zone over Los Angeles. So these foreign countries come in and they say no more airplanes over Los Angeles because the U.S. government is acting in a totalitarian way, terrorizing their own people. What would we say? Think about that. And so I just, man, I, you know, talk about give peace a chance. I mean, I just think that, you know, somehow we got this attitude that, you know, we should go and run every country in the world. I just don't understand that. And so now you're like, none of you are going to buy the book, right? Because I just, you know, forget give peace a chance. How about give enchantment a chance? So that just disturbs me. I don't know. I'm confused about that. Tell you the truth, I am really confused about that.
All right. All right, everybody. Well, thanks a lot for coming out tonight to see Guy Kawasaki and learn more about his amazing book, Enchantment. Line up. Tell him whether you want kick butt, nice butt, or something else on there, on the cover. And That's going to wrap it up for this
Commonwealth
Club meeting.
Thank you very much.